Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Ed Sheeran sitting with David Beckham, by the way, at the England-Germany game. Just thought I'd point that out.
Wow. Don't. Hey, everyone. I'm Molly Wood.
You don't know what to do with that, do you?
That broke me. It just broke me. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, the podcast where none of us is as smart as all of us.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, which means it is time to do a deep dive, as we do on these days, into a single topic. Today, fossil fuels and the future thereof, the industry specifically, and what the what with big oil, basically.
Yep, exactly. It is, of course, an all too prescient and all too perfectly timed week to be doing this, as power lines and streets in Portland are literally melting and buckling, or were yesterday, under what the, you know, meteorologists are calling an unprecedented heat bubble. The industry is, because of climate change, under a lot of pressure to move away from fossil fuels. Recently, of course, there were these big disruptions to big oil, including the addition of three activist shareholders on Exxon's board. This question, though, is really ultimately becoming more and more about business. Is this a major shift to the business of fossil fuel, which currently powers the global economy? What happens next?
Jason Bordoff is the director of the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. He also is a veteran of the Obama administration. Jason, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
All right. So look, thumbnail sketch to get us going here. Do you think big oil, and I understand that encompasses a lot of the energy sector out there, a lot of players, but do you think they see the handwriting on the wall? Because their actions don't necessarily indicate that they do.
I think they do, but it depends the time frame you're talking about. So in the longer term, achieving the climate goals, we must, as we saw, things are literally melting in Portland now, means a lot less oil and gas use to get to net zero. Not zero, but a lot less than today. Oil and gas firms need to be resilient to that transition. They need to plan for it and think about what strategies they can deploy that will work in a world where it's consuming much less oil and gas. That is not the world we're in now. There remains a significant gap between ambition and reality. So in the short term, oil prices are going up, oil use is going up, and companies are thinking ahead to how their strategies might evolve over time, but maybe understandably thinking about how they're going to capture this this next boom cycle, because right now oil demand is going up every year, not down.
Tell us a little bit about the state, though, of, before we get into sort of these specifics of what happened with Exxon, tell us about the state of the energy market as you understand it, because some of this is being driven by climate change, of course, but some of it's also being driven by the fact that renewable energy is cheap now, right?
Renewable energy is very cheap, and that means renewable deployment is growing very quickly. I mean, if you had said a decade ago, we would see solar costs fall 90%+, battery costs fall 90%, wind 60%, 70%. These are just staggering cost declines, and the growth rates are huge. At the same time, emissions are going up, other than a pandemic, each and every year. Coal use is going up. There's been a historic relationship that is very hard to break between GDP growth and population growth. And as the world gets wealthier and as the world gets more populated, it uses more energy. So the denominator is getting bigger. We're using more and more energy. And we need to not just meet all the incremental growth in energy use with zero carbon energy. We need to replace the 80% of the global energy mix that comes from fossil fuels with zero carbon sources, or otherwise capture and remove the CO2 associated with it. That 80% hasn't changed in decades.
Huh. So just to back you up for a minute, the growth rate that we're seeing in green and renewables, is that market forces driven? Is it government subsidy driven? What's happening?
It's both. I mean, it is often catalyzed by government policy, investment in early stage technology to drive down the cost when solar decades ago was seen as very expensive or batteries were very expensive. Government state renewable portfolio standards, mandates that you get a certain amount of your electricity from renewables, government investment in what was then early stage technology helps drive down the cost, advance the technology, so it becomes commercially viable. I mean, right now, the cheapest way to invest in meeting new electricity supply growth, electricity demand growth, is with zero carbon energy, often renewable sources of energy. We should remember, though, that only about 20-25% of global energy use is electricity, right? And we're not yet at a point in many other sectors, like parts of transportation with shipping and aviation, parts of heavy industry like steel and cement. Making steel around the world results in more carbon emissions than all the world's cars combined. These are big numbers, and it takes a different set of technologies than renewables to decarbonize those sectors.
So that's why, even though just as a matter of pure energy purchasing, renewables are cheaper, what you're describing is the reason that fossil fuel sort of resources are still in demand and why that demand is rising?
Demand is rising because energy use is rising. Renewables are meeting a lot of that, but not all of that. Mm-hmm. Coal is actually doing really well now. It's rebounding to its highest level since about 2014 when we thought it peaked. Coal prices are going up. Part of that is coming out of a pandemic, of course, so you would expect energy use to go up. But there remains, as I said, a really big gap between the promises that countries and companies are making to get to net zero by mid-century and the actual legally binding policies that are in place to require that they get to net zero by mid-century. Markets will do some of that because the cost of electric vehicles, maybe solar and wind, will just make those the cheapest ways to produce energy. It is not the cheapest way to fly an airplane or make cement or make steel or even power heavy-duty long-haul trucks. To do that in a zero-carbon way, we're going to need continued investment in technology to drive down the costs, and we're going to need policy to require it.
All right, so with the caveat that oil companies and energy companies, broadly speaking, are for-profit enterprises, let's talk for a second about governance and who's making the decisions about what these companies do. Molly alluded to it up at the top. The move, like a month ago now, by a smallish but now disproportionately effective hedge fund to get seats on ExxonMobil's board of people who want that company to transfer as a matter of a business imperative away from oil. The ruling in the Netherlands about Royal Dutch Shell having to account for the costs of its emissions. Do you see that, as a lot of people said at the time, as a tipping point?
I think we're seeing the aggregation of several tipping points that really are going to lead to significant change. I mean, this was a big day in terms of defeats for big oil. You had a court, as you said, in the Netherlands telling Shell it not only needs to reduce its own emissions, but be responsible for reducing, slashing the emissions from the use of the oil it produces by all of us when we get in our cars and turn the lights on and do other things. For a company of Exxon size to lose three seats on its board, backed by large asset managers like BlackRock and Vanguard. I mean, that's a major setback. All of that reflects a really strong rising sense of urgency to deal with the climate crisis driven by, as we said, the impacts we're already seeing today and growing social and investor pressure for corporate America and Wall Street to pivot and take these issues more seriously. At the same time, if all we do is pressure some of these big oil firms, that may or may not actually help climate by reducing emissions, again, unless what I mentioned a minute ago, the policy and technology helps to drive down oil use. We talk about big oil, but the oil majors that we always talk about, Shell, Exxon, BP, Total, they're only 15% of the world's oil and gas supply. Most of the world's oil and gas comes from other private companies that are smaller or national oil companies. Russia, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Aramco in Saudi Arabia. As long as oil use remains unchanged or even grows, other companies are going to be there to buy the assets that those oil majors sell or maybe increase their own production. ADNOC in the United Arab Emirates, Aramco in Saudi Arabia, Rosneft in Russia, they're all investing today to increase their oil production capacity, notwithstanding talk of the transition, because they see the ambition getting ahead of the reality and the world the world's oil use is going up, not down.
So how do we bring down demand?
Well, we need a set of technological advances to we've done a lot of that, say, with cars. We know what the alternative to cars looks like to electrify those. We need policy to help make that happen through subsidies, building out electric vehicle charging networks. You'll start to see more disruptive policies like maybe bans on the internal combustion engine, as California announced recently. We need innovation to help drive that forward in parts of the economy that are harder right now to electrify, heavy-duty trucks, ships, airplanes. We're going to need investment in technology to figure out what the alternatives are going to be there.
So this is
and part of that's going to be the private sector. Part of it's going to be government. We're going to have public-private cooperation in terms of who makes those investments to bring down the cost of new technologies.
Mm-hmm. So this is none of my business, and you can tell me to pound sand if you want to. But I ask this in all seriousness because of the scope of the problem. How do you get out of bed in the morning? Because, you know, I have a tough enough time dealing with stupid bureaucratic stuff in my own stupid little company here. And this is a global and cataclysmic problem.
It is. And that's what sort of drives you to get up out of bed in the morning. The truth is, you know, we are at Columbia University, not only have the Center on Global Energy Policy, which I lead, but I've also been asked by the president of the university to help lead the new climate school. We're the first university creating an entire new school, think on the scale of a law school, a business school, medical school focused on this problem. And I will tell you that we have our first class of students coming in the fall, about 90 master students. And when you talk to the young people today, the not only how brilliant they are, but the sense of passion and commitment they have to combating this crisis and making it their life's work. That's pretty inspiring in terms of what gets you up in the morning.
Tell me about, in fact, on that note, let's sort of, you know, zoom out to the globe level, because there's a lot that, of course, could happen in the United States as a very big market and driver of markets. But there are a lot of countries that are, you know, where that aren't electrified at all. And if they all come online, you know, I have one source who frequently says, if Indonesia comes online with diesel or coal, we're all going to cook. Like, what does this sort of global ambition look like with entrepreneurs and the people that you're talking about who are incentivized to solve this problem?
I think you're raising a huge issue. We don't actually focus enough on where the emissions growth is coming from. Mm-hmm. I mean, 95% of the emissions growth between today and the end of the century is outside the United States. And, you know, we've talked a lot about China. China's roughly starting to plateau its emissions, but they're going to continue to rise, or India. But when you look at Southeast Asia, you add up countries like Vietnam and Indonesia, you put them all together. I mean, there's really rapid economic growth there. We haven't even started to talk about, say, the continent of Africa. Historically, the United States is responsible for 25% of all the emissions to date. Remember, it's not the annual flow that matters. It's the stock cumulative amount of CO2 because it stays up there for a very long time. All of Africa is responsible for 2%. They're not emitting anything yet. That's because their energy use is so low. Their standard of living is so low. We want that to go up. We want them to have a higher standard of living. But with that economic growth and prosperity that everyone wants, unless we follow a very different path moving forward than we have in the past, that's going to be huge amounts of emissions growth. So we need to think about a whole different model for industrialization and economic development. So they do follow a different path, and that's going to require a lot of investment, say, in the U.S. or Europe, on technologies we will need, like maybe hydrogen to decarbonize sectors like steel and cement, to make those reasonably affordable. So countries with much less resources than we have, you know, it's a feasible and affordable for them to pursue a different kind of path. It's not fair to ask them to pay a significant premium when they haven't historically been responsible for the problem.
Yeah, or to limit their own growth, right? I mean, that's the deal.
Or to limit their own growth. And, right. and if you, you know, the International Energy Agency recently released a analysis, the first one they've ever done, modeling what it would look like to get to net zero emissions by 2050. And there's a lot of pretty staggering findings in how the magnitude of that challenge. Like, you take the world's largest solar park today and you need to build one of those every day between now and 2050. One of the most, I thought, staggering was that in their finding, in 2050, the world's using less energy in total than it is today. That doesn't sit well with parts of the world that are using a tiny fraction of what we sort of take for granted every day. So we're going to have to figure out how to make sure that they can continue to enjoy growing standards of living, but do it on a different trajectory. That's going to need policy, financial assistance, development aid, and technological improvements.
Does the United States have, do you think, Jason, the moral standing to go to other countries and say, hey, look, we really need your help here?
Well, I think the challenge the U.S. has, to be frank, is that we have flip-flopped a lot in our policies. So, you know, I worked in the Clinton administration, and they joined the Kyoto Protocol, and then Bush backed out. And then we negotiated the Paris Agreement when I worked in the Obama administration, and then obviously Trump reversed course. So we have had too many flip-flops in our own policy. Our own political system in D.C. right now, you know, is worryingly dysfunctional to tackle a big problem like climate change. At the same time, it's just tremendous to see how significant a priority the Biden administration has made this, to see someone of the stature of former Secretary of State John Kerry out there trying to get countries to elevate their ambition. We need to put our money where our mouth is. If we're going to get other countries to elevate ambition, we need to put in place policies that show we are on a lower carbon trajectory as well. That's why something like the infrastructure package being negotiated in Washington now is so important.
Right. You mentioned that, for example, Russia and Saudi Arabia are, you know, spooling up oil operations, happy to meet that demand. It is going to take countries saying, you know, no, we don't want to be in this business in order to really make this change. And so far, the U.S. is still very much in that business, so to speak.
Well, and someone's going to step in to meet demand as long as demand is still there. I mean, you look at what was it that knocked U.S. shale production, this kind of revolution in how much oil we were producing that had been growing year after year, what caused it to finally fall off a cliff quite quickly was a collapse in oil demand driven, in that case, by a pandemic and a shutdown in economic activity. That's not the way we want to do it. But what we need to do is really put in place much stronger measures. And again, the technologies we'll need to have oil demand not rise each and every year, but start falling and falling pretty quickly.
Jason Bordoff is the director of the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia, also a veteran of the Clinton White House, the Obama White House. Jason, thanks a lot for your time. We appreciate it.
Wonderful to speak with you. Thanks.
Take care.
I was a serious question. How do you get out of bed, man? I'm telling you.
There, I mean, I read an article actually about how climate anxiety, I have brought this up. Like, I have literally sat in therapy and been like, I'm freaking out about the planet. Well, and it is becoming a real mental health issue because it's becoming more and more, it's more and more real to people. And, you know, hopefully the equal and opposite reaction to that is that it's more and more real. And therefore, we should get our butts in gear.
Yeah.
Even if the better time to do that was 100 years ago, the second best time is today, I think they say.
That's a good line. That's a good line. He's laughing so he doesn't cry. All right. We're going to a break, as we usually do here on a Tuesday. Send us your comments on today's show or any show that you may have heard or that you would like to hear. You can do it by sending us an email. Voice memos work as well. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org. Be right back.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
And we're back.
We are.
Just like that. We're just back. It is time for a quick news fix. Maybe sometimes I feel like we should start incorporating Make Me Smile into the Tuesday show.
I know, right? Just because. Just
because. Sometimes we come back from our big media interviews and we're like, oh, but here's some more.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm gonna keep going with that. And this is a thing from the California Department of Public Health, also from the World Health Organization yesterday. Even if you are fully vaccinated, if you are inside in a public establishment, grocery store, theater, movie, whatever, they think you should wear the mask, a mask, because of the Delta variant. And we're seeing a tick up in hospitalizations and deaths here in Los Angeles County. Nothing like we were seeing in January and February, but they're ticking up, and we know how these things get out of control in a big, bad hurry. So if you're inside like that, wear a mask is what they want you to do. And yikes.
I know.
Yikes.
This thing is a little scary. I mean, again, the vaccines do really, really seem to work against this variant, but the more infection that spreads, the more powerful the variants get.
Right. Right.
And that's why, in case you're wondering why I'm vaccinated, why do I have to do this? It's because you could, you know, it's like a 0.4% chance of you contracting this thing if you're vaccinated, something like that. But the more it spreads, the worse the variants get. And it's scary. I read a piece yesterday that said 99% of deaths in the U.S. now are people who are unvaccinated.
Yeah, yeah, it's a pandemic of the unvaccinated here in the United States. I was thinking this morning of Ben Holiday as I heard the news.
Me too.
That Australia, the big cities in Australia, are locking down now for 2 weeks. Ben is in Sydney, as he has shared on Twitter, so I'm not you know, spilling any secrets here. But he is now back down in a 2 week lockdown because, first of all, the vaccination rates there are terrible, but also because they've got the Delta variant spreading. And it's just, it gets bad so quickly. So,
yeah, it really does. So I have been, I like a lot of people and journalists and policymakers have been staying away from this question of where the virus came from. This conversation has just gotten so much more interesting. And now there is, you know, real and good science reporting behind it. And it's a really interesting example of like a whole bunch of things, like how groupthink can get totally out of control in one way or the other. But also the kind of ongoing human question of like, just because we can, does that mean we should? So there have been two pieces lately that I recommend to you. One is, of course, obviously, Zeynep Tufekci in the New York Times, who had a really long piece on, you know, what we know and what we don't know. And she was very, very careful and precise and detailed in looking into this question. And, you know, of course, the question is, what research was being done? I'm going to start by saying, nobody made this thing and released it on purpose. The end. The end. However, there is a lot of science and research that goes into understanding viruses because they pose a big threat to us, particularly this coronavirus family, which, you know, exists everywhere in all kinds of animals, clearly has the potential to spread to humans. And so a lot of research has been done to try to understand these viruses. And there's a specific type of research known as gain of function research, where you do manipulate a virus to test a hypothesis, such as could it spread from, you know, animals to humans? If it did spread, what would happen? It is very high risk research. Everyone knows that. The National Institutes for Health have sort of off and on funded this research in the United States and then, you know, stopped funding it and then funded it on the condition that it would be done under certain extremely safe conditions, or that there would be research into the behavior of viruses that wouldn't be about manipulating them to make them more transmissible. So there have been a couple of stories that have come out, Zeynep, and today in the MIT Technology Review that I think you should read very closely, because what it suggests is that some of this research was being done, yes, in the United States under very secure conditions, and yes, at the Wuhan Institute of Virology under far less secure conditions.
Yeah.
And that is it for what we know. Think of this as like the UFO report, right?
right.
We know that they are unidentified flying objects or whatever it is the Pentagon called them.
Yeah.
We do not know that they are aliens.
Yep.
But increasingly, we do know that this research into this virus family, coronaviruses, was being done under less than ideal conditions, like what one scientist called scandalous conditions in terms of the security of the lab.
Yes.
And we have to take it seriously.
Yep.
Because this research is going to be ongoing, and the United States did fund some of it, and it's just going to, it's like a, I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, you should read it.
You should read it. And also, sorry, let me just chime in here on the political reality of this discussion, right? Because it has become politicized, desperately so.
Desperately so.
And that's not helping. So the thing you can do is just be informed. Sorry, my plug for an informed
citizen. No, that's exactly
right
it. And we, and I, this is the kind of thing where I get furious at myself for thinking like, oh, I shouldn't talk about this, right? Of course, we have to talk about this. These are facts.
Yeah.
This is science. This is information we should all have. We should know what is happening where and what our government is or is not funding. And we should not lie about it in the interest of furthering our partisan gains.
Yes.
And that's why I want you to read this so that when you start to hear a bunch of crazy talk and lies about it, you'll be able to recognize it, but you will also know what may or may not be true.
Yes.
And that's our whole job here.
Yep.
The true stuff.
The other part of our job, unless you're going to go with item two on your list of,
nope.
of spectaculars.
Nope. No.
Okay. The other part of our job is to hear from you, which is the cue for Charlton Thorpe across the glass
nice.
To hit the mailbag cue. There it is.
Hello,
segue,
Molly
bro.
And Connor.
Right? It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
Megan, Michigan, voice memo, go.
I was just catching up and listening to the Tuesday Big Show about critical race theory and Kimberly's story about the rich getting richer during the pandemic. What Kai said struck home to me because my husband and I own our home, and during the pandemic, when interest rates dropped to nothing, we were in a position to refinance our home. And to me, that is exactly an example of what Kai was talking about, even though I am not what I would consider one of the 1% or wealthier or whatever, I still was in a position to take advantage of the downturn in a way that a lot of people weren't. And that seems unfair to me, and I'm not sure what to do about it. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because that's exactly mm-hmm. what that comment was, right? Those who have the capital, those who have the assets, are in a position to gain from it by doing something as basic as refining a house, right? But yeah. if you're a person of color working a minimum wage job in an apartment where you have a tough time making the rent, you don't get to participate in that part of capitalism. And that's what keeps the rich richer and the poor not. Exactly right.
And I think to Megan's question, you know, I'm not sure what to do about, like, this moment of understanding
mm-hmm.
is exactly what happens as a result of these repeated conversations, that you right. understand that the position you're in, you know, in no way would I ever suggest that Megan and her husband did not work hard and deserve to own their home. And that it's also true that someone else was probably denied yeah. that opportunity by these structural inequities that are built into our system all the way going back to the Constitution. And it's literally the understanding of that that makes everything better. It's the realization yeah. that like, oh, I have this thing. I think that I 100% earned it. A million, you know, it was all me, no other factors. And it's understanding these other factors that moves us all forward.
What Molly
so
said.
Megan, you're good.
Yeah.
You already made you're good. All right, Don in Tucson. Oh my God. The list of things that Kai is not a fan of. Don in Tucson.
I was shocked
sent
to
us
hear
this.
That you weren't an X-Files fan. But no worries.
Oh
we are many. In fact, my husband and myself are such fans.
We
named our two rescue dogs, Fox Mulder and Dana Scully. They also have official FBI badges. FBI for federal barking investigators.
Wow.
Love the show, and always remember
wow.
the fans are out there.
Yes!
Oh, man.
The one that really killed me was when you said you had never even heard of The Expanse.
Yeah, what?
Never even heard of it. Never seen an ad. Nothing.
Oh, look. We've come to the portion of the program where Kai gets dumped on. Ah, yes. My favorite every week. Oh,
it's
my
okay.
goodness.
There is so much pop culture that I don't engage.
Fair
I am
enough.
The person on every walk Fair with the girlfriends, enough. And they're like, "Have you seen this like weepy documentary show or like this like you know the period piece drama, because it's not, and I'm always like, no, no, yeah. No. This is why we nerds have to defend ourselves so strongly.
Fair enough. Yeah, no, I get that. That's totally fair.
But
totally
yes, fair. Yeah, it's, yeah. No.
All right.
It's cool.
All right. So last week, Andrew in Houston told us he'd finished paying off his student loans. Kimberly asked him to let us know what he planned to do with the extra cash he's going to have every month, not writing those checks. Here's what he said.
Finally purchased a smartwatch.
Oh, nice.
Purchased the materials needed to fire up, literally, another side hustle.
What?
Make updates to a homemade foundry I constructed that I used to melt aluminum into objects.
Whoa.
State-shaped paperweights, throwing knives, household objects, challenge coins.
What?
Purchase a recumbent bicycle or a kayak so I can have some relaxing time on the road or on the water. Lastly, and probably where the money will all end up going if we're honest, I've got 4 kids under 10 years of age, so it will likely turn into purchasing things and experiences for them, or letting my wife do some more Target runs.
Yes, it's certainly, that last thing is where the money's going to go. But I want to hear more about this homemade foundry where he melts aluminum. What could possibly go wrong? What could possibly go wrong? What are you doing, Dad?
I'm going
out in the garage to melt some aluminum. No.
Dude, people are so interesting. Everyone is doing so many interesting things. He's like, yeah, I just melt aluminum into objects and stuff like you do in your garage.
That was one.
That was awesome.
Yes. Oh, my Lord. Okay.
Wow.
Whew. That was a good one. No,
I know, we're just going to need recurring calls from him.
That's right. No, but to that point, I really appreciate the follow-up because that was cool. Yep. All right. End of the show. Make me smart question, as it always is. What is something you thought you knew you later found out you were wrong about? Michael in Florida, he's in aerospace is what he does. Here you go.
What I thought I knew, but I later found out I was wrong about, is that a 4-10 schedule is terrible for anyone with a family. With a 10-hour schedule and a mandatory 30-minute lunch break and 30-minute commute on the front and the back end of my day, I am left with about 2 usable hours with my family at home, which basically accounts for homework and getting kids ready for school just for their next day. Additionally, it has proved next to impossible to find consistent childcare for a 12-hour period. I now know that I will gladly take a small reduction in salary if I could only work a 4-8 schedule. This would allow me to still have the 3-day weekend, and I can still enjoy more time with my family.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about 4-10 schedules not too long ago. Yeah, there's not enough time in the day to do everything you want to do. That's life in America.
It also is really draconian for us to sort of think like, well, you still have to work 40 hours.
Yeah.
We'll just jam it into 4 days.
Yep.
Like, that's not a solution either. That is not a flexible. There might be some people who want to do that, but yes, exactly. I think what you guys talked about is the need for a not one size fits all work solution. Also, I just want to shout out Bumble. Maybe you guys talked about this and I missed it. I tried to get caught up on all the shows. The company Bumble, which runs a dating app, gave the entire company a week off. The entire company a week off.
Yeah.
Hello, everyone. Yeah. That's how you deal with burnout at your company. Just throwing that out there.
At your company. If anybody who's listening to this runs
whatever
a company,
your company
where
is.
Molly and I work. Anyway, don't forget to send us your answer to Make Me Smart question. Once again, what is something you thought you knew, later found out you were wrong about? You can reach us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. You remember in the early days of the Daily shows, I started giving Deb a hard time about not listening all the way to the end. I should start doing that again to the powers that be, because they're not listening. Nobody's listening. That's all I'm saying.
I'm just saying, like, why are all companies, including ours, but every other company, like, understand that burnout is real and take care of people, especially at a time when everybody's quitting their jobs?
That's right.
Isn't this the moment to
retention risk is the phrase you're looking for here.
I believe it is. Turnover is expensive. Yes. Anyway, Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and our smart speaker skills. Our intern is Grace Rubin.
Sorry for all the rest of you. I don't have time for the credits.
That's our fault.
Ran out of music.
Sorry, bad.
Sorry.
Okay, bye.
We'll get you next time.
Charlton's like, I don't need to hear my name. I just ran the short music.
He literally he's laughing. He just rolled his chair away from the board, took a cup of coffee, and he's laughing.
I'm Tanya Mosley, In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.